Hey everyone, welcome back to the 443 Security Simplified. I'm your host, Mark the Liberty, and joining me today is...
Corey Unshowered Knockreiner. Is anyone taking showers anymore?
You also don't have an image on your green screen, and I'm super disappointed by that.
We're on Teams, I didn't want to open up Minicam.
On today's episode, we have a few news stories to go with you, including an advisory from the NCSC and the CISA, some pretty interesting payment card skimming malware, and research from McAfee, and then a fun little story at the end. With that, let's go ahead and hop on in.
Hop in, huh? Like a little bunny foo-foo?
Hop in. We're back to hopping.
Good job. I will simply call you little bunny foo-foo.
I quit. So let's start with the first news topic today. Analysts last week at Malwarebytes published their analysis of a pretty interesting method of delivery for some payment card skimming malware. We talked, it would have been, I think, last month or maybe the month before about Magecart on this podcast and how it's a type of payment card skimming malware that would try and steal information out of forms and send it off to the bad guys. This one is similar, but not actually Magecart, and it was really interesting how they actually delivered it to the site. So Malwarebytes started their investigation when they noticed a correlation between malicious payment card skimming JavaScript on websites that were also retrieving favicons from a site called myicons.net. And they first noticed when they went to that myicons.net site that it had only been registered a few days prior and was also, it actually stole all of its content from a legitimate favicon site, iconarchives.com, by hosting that site inside of an iframe element. So iframe elements, a HTML element on a page that basically lets you load another page inside of a page. In this case, it was loading the entirety of that icon archive site.
By the way,
we've also seen it in use.
The iframe is also something you might have heard of that is sometimes referred to as an invisible pixel because, I mean, legitimately iframes are meant to be a portion of the browsing window, like navigation bars or something. That's commonly what you'd use an iframe for. Like if you had a header and a side navigation bar, you'd use an iframe to sort different HTML content there. But it's a common trick that you can actually make a 1 pixel or 0 pixel iframe that literally doesn't show up in the window, but loads a lot of off domain, in some cases, content.
Like JavaScript for exploit kits or possibly other malware as well. Funny enough, in this case, so Malwarebytes showed a side-by-side. Whoever spun up this fake icon website, they didn't even try and like hide the fact they were copying over iconarchive.com. Like it included that site's banner and everything on the main page. The only thing that was different was the URL and the address bar. So they suspected, though, that the file image that was returned from myicons.net contained malicious code. But when they went just in their sandbox, I suppose, to go download the PNG file directly, it was actually just a legitimate Adobe Magento logo. Like it was an actual image. There wasn't any malicious code in it at all. And it wasn't until that they added a URL of a compromised website and the referrer header to the request that they sent to myicons.net that instead of returning that Magento logo, it actually returned a bunch of malicious JavaScript code that consisted of a credit card payment form, which it used to override the PayPal checkout option on these sites, and then also some additional JavaScript to inject into other forms to steal like names, addresses, everything you might need to go along with a credit card.
And this is, for the listener out there, that this is kind of a sophisticated technique that web-based attackers use. And what I mean by that is this website was looking for something to appear in a header before it delivered its malicious content. As researchers, our team sees this all the time. Some examples are just user agents. Like if you have a web-based exploit kit, there's no reason to display malicious content to people that aren't going to be vulnerable. So you can use things like user agent header agents, basically the user agent header is what it's called, to see what kind of browser or client, whether it's a mobile device, a normal device, and decide whether or not to serve your malicious content to it. And it's as Mark mentioned, in this case, it could be the referrer header. It could be looking for a little extra header that has a message ID or something that's associated with a link you clicked in an email. And they do this for a number of reasons. One is simply, like I said, making sure they only go for people they can really target with their attacks. But the second is purely just evasion, right? As security companies like ours get sent suspicious links to look at, if they're looking at an IP blacklist or they're looking for special ID tags or user agent headers, if we're not very smart about spoofing that ourselves, we may not ever see the malicious content and assume the page is okay. So it just shows you how smart attackers are getting and how good they are at obfuscating and not delivering their attack to everyone in hopes of hiding better.
You'll see, actually, by the time this podcast comes out, a blog post from one of our analysts, Trevor, who actually found a phishing site that would only display the malicious or the actual phish if the web page was rendered in about the resolution and size of a mobile phone. So when he went to go visit it on a computer, it didn't show anything until he resized the browser to look like a mobile device because the phish originated from a text message.
And sometimes they're not that sophisticated. Sometimes they may not look for that, and that's kind of a sign of a less sophisticated web attack. But we're seeing more and more frameworks that kind of have this functionality built in. When you can buy these web exploit frameworks on the underground, sometimes this functionality is built into the framework for you.
This is like the gold package for the exploit kit in a box that you buy off hackerforum.com.
They got the total insecurity bundle from the underground service.
Well done. In this case, the skimmer itself is actually known as the ant and cockroach skimmer, due to the name of a function inside of it that was previously identified. I guess it's got a function called ant cockroach.
I thought it was called that because all cyber criminals are all small-minded cockroaches.
Oh boy, we just got a big target painted on our back. Luckily, in this case, Malwarebytes identified the threat, and for if you're a WatchGuard customer, all the exfiltration domains and the skimmer delivery domains are blocked by DNS Watch, so you're safe if you've got total security. But I wanted to highlight this because it was pretty interesting evasion techniques they were using there. And like you said, it's getting easier for them to add this sort of technique. And so we'll probably see similar styles like this going forward now too.
That said, it is a sign of a more sophisticated actor. I must admit, if we stumble upon sites that are using this technique, we tend to get a little more excited because it might be something cool and new and dangerous that we definitely want to know about and block first.
Yep, I agree entirely. So next up, the UK National Cybersecurity Center, and that's center with an RE, not an ER. And the US Cyber Infrastructure Security Agency, or CISA, released a joint statement last week highlighting ongoing activity by APTs, or Advanced Persistent Threats, against healthcare and essential services. So the six-page advisory stated that unnamed hacking groups are targeting organizations in order to collect bulk personal information, intellectual property, and intelligence that aligns with national priorities. And in the advisory, they mentioned a couple of the techniques that the attackers are using in order to gain access to the networks of these organizations. They mentioned a specific Citrix vulnerability from last year, some vulnerabilities in various VPN products, and then also that attackers are actively using password spraying as a technique. We've talked about credential stuffing a few times. I think it's been a while since we talked about password spraying. You want to go over that one, Corey?
Yeah, just to remind you guys, credential stuffing is when you take specific stolen credentials from the underground. So these are like real specific credentials often associated with an email, and you tried those credentials somewhere else. Whereas password spraying is similar but different. Password spraying is taking the most common passwords. So it doesn't necessarily have to be a specific credential associated with an email. It's just some of the very, very common passwords, again, typically gathered from lots of leaks and launching those against a site. And if you're a smart site, I'm sure Mark will get into the second part of this. If you're a smart site, one of the ways to protect against things like whether it be credential stuffing or password spraying is to monitor, throttle, and limit bad logons. So, you know, simply throttling how often someone can try and fail to log in can help with these attacks. Whereas also, of course, having a lockout mechanism after X amount of bad tries, you can totally lock them out. But a segue to the rest of the story, Mark.
Yeah, exactly. So one of the interesting things from this advisory is they noted how the attackers were getting around lockout protections. So instead of picking an account and then spraying the top whatever 50 most common passwords against it, which would probably get it locked out, they're trying a single password against a large number of accounts before moving on to a second password. So they're spreading it out so that by the time they come around to potentially a second failure on that account, it's most likely outside that lockout or throttling window.
That would definitely help specifically with the throttling, because they're just not submitting that quickly for individual accounts by using different names. May or may not affect the lockout. Now, the lockout probably has a throttle too, meaning how quickly you have to try another password and fail before it counts it as a second or third or fourth attempt. So I guess it could get past lockout mechanisms too. But I think it was probably primarily trying to get past throttling methods.
Yep. And this, just the fact that healthcare and essential services are being targeted, this isn't the first time we've talked about this either. Like, there was that Vietnamese-linked government group that was going after China in order to steal information.
And by the way, it's like COVID-19, at least according to the alert they published, it seems to be COVID-19 intellectual property they're specifically targeting. They're trying to learn about COVID-19 research.
And when they're saying healthcare, it's not just hospitals. They're going after research facilities and pharmaceutical companies to try and steal intellectual property. So most likely vaccines in that case, or treatments. And I mean, I guess it kind of makes sense that you would see this stuff going around. I have to imagine that if you get a working vaccine, it's going to be worth a heck of a lot of money worldwide. And so if you can steal one, it's probably worth just as much.
I hope that's not the case. I hope it's just so they can cure people. You know, all hacking is bad. I don't think hacking's good. But frankly, when you have a pandemic, the research to cure it should be open source.
I'm with you on that. Yes. But I guess the other targets that these criminals are going after, like bulk personal information, probably means that there's a bit more of a nefarious side to what they're trying to get out of this, unfortunately. So if you are in the healthcare industry vertical, watch out for password spraying. Set up account lockouts on whatever services you have exposed to the internet, or even internally, I suppose, because they could manage to pivot off something inside. And check out the alert that NCSC and CISA published, because it's got some additional tips there as well on how to keep yourself safe from these threat actors.
Also, by the way, if you are an employee or user at these organizations, you should be using random passwords in a password manager, and hopefully common passwords or even your own personal leaked passwords in the public should not be the ones you're currently using for your organization.
Yeah, exactly. What was I gonna? Oh yeah. So interestingly, the reason this alert came out was they noted a few times throughout it that they were actively investigating incidents from this. So personally, I'm looking forward to seeing if they publish details on it, because I know CISA does tend to publish more details when they have them and when they're able to attribute things. So it'd be interesting to see if something comes out of that in the next few weeks or so. So next up, another one that's, I guess, somewhat related to the COVID pandemic, specifically by individuals having to work remotely now. Researchers at McAfee have been tracking the number of exposed RDP, or remote desktop protocol, servers exposed on the internet using the Shodan search engine. So we've talked about Shodan a few times. It's called basically what the Google for IoT, but it's much more than that, where it goes through and it fingerprints exposed ports and services on the internet, identifies what protocol they're exposing, down to what operating system or patch level of application they're using. And then you can go through as a researcher or an attacker and basically build reports and identify potential targets, or for example, if a new vulnerability comes out, the number of vulnerable systems out there. So McAfee for the past few months has been tracking the number of RDP servers, so remote desktop servers, exposed to the internet. And they noted that in the first quarter of this year, the number of RDP servers went from 3 million to 4.5 million, with the overwhelming majority of them in the US and China. And a large number of them, if I remember from the pie chart, it looked like around 30 to 40% were running either Windows 7 or Server 2008 R2.
Ooh.
Yeah. Both of which are technically out of support now, though you can still get security patches for them with special contracts. And this, I wanted to use this as an opportunity to talk again about securing remote working from home. We had a whole episode basically dedicated to this, but I remember even from like my support days that it's really common for network administrators or sysadmins or whoever manages the firewall UTM thing to just punch a hole through for RDP and allow people to remote desktop directly to their servers or terminal servers or whatever.
Yeah, specifically, this is usually the IT guys, right? Like when we say this is working from home, this is actually specifically giving the IT guy direct server access to something that's probably on premise that he has to manage from a technical perspective. And he's working at home and he wants to be able to access it. So very common, but I'm sure we'll talk about if just exposing it's the right way.
No, it's not, because we've seen this in quite a few examples as a avenue for the attacker to get into the front door. So if you expose RDP out there to the internet, it basically allows anyone that identifies that open port, which is as easy as just looking up your computer in Shodan, it allows them to hammer away and brute force their way into that, or they could exploit a known vulnerability. Like we just had a bunch of RDP, like what was it, Bluekeep RDP vulnerabilities later last year, where if you haven't kept it up to date, they don't even need to try and guess a username and password to get in. They can just exploit that and execute code as they want on that system.
And of course, the credential stuffing we talked about. I mean, if they somehow get one of your employees' credentials, you know, just because the RDP might have encrypted traffic, who cares? They've logged in as your user, and now it looks like your user is making valid changes. And by the way, we've talked about MSP targeted attacks a number of times on this show. Besides the early on ConnectWise plugin ones, which had a vulnerability, some of the new ones are assumed to be stolen credentials. And while it hasn't been proven 100%, there in many of the cases for the affected MSPs, they had RDP exposures all over the place. And it's somewhat presumed that the RDP had something to do with either how the people got some credentials or how they got in using credentials for the initial breach. So RDP is a heavily targeted service. You know, you might think, oh, I should be able to use it on the internet because it has its own encryption. You know, yeah, it does, but if you don't have multi-factor on the RDP authentication, you have a problem. So what to do about this, by the way, Mark, we can both talk about it, but I guess you could probably add MFA directly to the RDP authentication, but I think you and I probably both agree that our preference for IT guys is VPN is great. You can have a VPN connection. It adds an extra level of security validation and encryption. Plus, you can definitely add MFA multi-factor authentication to our VPN connection. And then you don't have to punch any RDP service hole. You can have the RDP access locally through that VPN connection.
Yep, I agree. Because like even adding MFA to it doesn't protect you from things like Bluekeep. That completely bypasses authentication entirely and just gives them access right to the server. And like it doesn't have to even be like a client VPN, like, you know, L2TP or SSL or whatever. Just about every single client list VPN under the sun now supports RDP access, where you can spin up basically a landing page, protect that with authentication, and from there click on resources like servers and pop up a client list RDP tunnel directly to them.
I'll also add that is our preference. If for whatever reason, I don't know what that reason would be, but if you can't add a VPN to something, at the very least, you should have, if you're going to create an open up RDP policy, you should create some sort of access control to it. That means, you know, rather than exposing it to the internet, only expose it to domains or IP addresses under your control. And or, I mean, you can also use, we have capabilities with our Firebox, and I'm sure others do too, where you can have authentication. You know, the port's not open to everyone. Someone has to authenticate from any IP, but once they authenticate, then suddenly it opens up the policy to that authenticated user. So for that, we do a web portal authentication. So I still think VPN's better, but if for some reason you can't do that, again, I can't imagine why not. But at the very least, put some sort of access control around this policy. Don't just expose it to the internet.
And stick intrusion prevention on it to at least catch the known exploits that are going to it. But I mean, I would go so far as to say it's 2020 and exposing RDP to the internet is just not
Yeah, it's
cool.
almost as bad as telling
And
it. Maybe not
exactly.
that bad, but but we'll pretend.
It's up there though, at least. So we always tend to end the podcast episodes on like a downer, like oh well, here's this massive exploit or something that there's
Let's
really no
watch
help
the
in fixing.
world burn.
Exactly. And I wanted to end this one on something that we can hopefully all like have a bit of a laugh at, or at least a oh wow, what a dummy moment together. So last week, German prosecutors issued an arrest warrant for a gentleman named Dmitry Bodin, who is a Russian GRU-linked hacker who was accused of hacking the German parliament back in 2015. He's also one of the individuals that's been accused by U.S. authorities of being behind the DNC and the Clinton campaign hacks leading up to the 2016 election. And so you would think that, like, I mean, he is obviously pretty savvy at phishing, probably savvy at other hacking techniques. We'll mention some of the links to the GRU as well. I'd have to imagine you're pretty good at malicious hacking to join up in that organization. And while they were savvy enough to fish their way into several of these organizations, it actually turns out they lacked quite a bit of OPSEC or operational security. So, for example, we found this site, bellingcat.com, which this is my actual first time visiting it. Corey, I think you mentioned you had only seen it a couple of days ago as
Yeah,
well.
simply because of this link.
Yeah. It looks like they're like an independent, or they bill themselves as an independent investigatory journalist platform where people can go in and share their open source intelligence and research to try and like identify interesting
By the way,
things.
there's a, I forget, I feel like they're based in Canada, but I know there's some other kind of open source cyber intelligence group, and it's the one that's usually, you know, how sometimes the Chinese threat actors go after Tibet and journalists. It was another kind of the same, it sounds like the same type of thing, this open source group of experts that comes together to uncover hacks against journalists, politicians, or like minorities that are being targeted by political groups.
So as soon as the German prosecutors released their arrest warrant and information on this individual, some users on this website went and dug into his past, basically, and found a lot of really interesting things. So, for example, if you search Dmitry Bowden's full name and date of birth in a previously leaked database of Moscow car registrations, you'll find that he registered his car, which he purchased in 2018, to the address of the GRU Military Unit 26165, which specializes in cryptography. He's actually not the only person to register his car to this address. Quite a few other known operatives of GRU registered their cars to this address. They were able to also, so this is how they linked him to that government-sponsored hacking unit, along with finding one of his favorite online usernames in the source code of some malware that came from that hacking unit as well. The best bit, though, this is my favorite bit. So, in their research, they were able to find his email address via his Skype account, which was linked to his phone number, which was taken from that leaked car registration database. They somewhat confirmed that the Skype name was actually his because it also used several of his known preferred account names and pseudonyms online. So, using his email address, they were then able to look through the recent mail.ru data breach of a whole bunch of Russian leaked email addresses and plain text passwords. And they were able to get his password, which was his last name and his year of birth, 1990. Which, funny enough, even in a more recent breach, he appears to have at least changed his password, but he just took off the one in 1990. So now it's just Baden 990.
Yeah, I by the way, I agree that it's kind of a nice Schadenfreude feeling for us to see, you know, these attackers or cyber actors getting doxxed. But I actually don't feel like I should make fun of his OPSEC too much because I think almost no one can have the OPSEC you need in this digital world. Like, I don't think we realize how many of our digital, like a lot of people think, oh, I'll just use Tor combined with incognito mode and I'll be fine. I don't think we realize how much data is tied to every single application we use, which is calling home, all types of different cookies, super cookies, pieces of JavaScript that can identify you even if you're using anonymization services. We're just being so connected in so many different ways that can all be correlated very easily, that you would have to always be on your game 24/7 to ever have the right OPSEC. I mean, the only way to have the right OPSEC is literally to, every time you're doing some sort of red team campaign, using a VM that you've spun up for that session, you're using fresh installs of everything, and you literally kill that machine and have to reset it up every single time you do a campaign. So, yay for us kind of tracking this dude down and doxing him because he is a criminal. But it's hard to make fun of anyone's OPSEC. I think you could do this to almost any person on the
I'm
internet.
more happy with finding out that he has one of the worst passwords I've ever seen from someone that was allegedly behind quite a few pretty high profile
That's a
hacks.
good point.
But you do make a good point. Like, if you want good OPSEC, you should be like me and do all of your hacking from a toaster behind seven proxies.
Except seven proxies don't save you if your toaster is spitting out little header information that you don't know about. So
All the
make sure
proxies are toasters
you've
too. They don't
cleaned
pass
your
on
toaster. Oh,
headers.
good. There you go. Well, good luck. I remember for the people out there, for someone that left the company who we really liked, we created a WatchGuard wireless toaster. It was a red double bread toaster that had wireless antennas, and I think someone even fitted at the time one of our Wi-Fi Sohos into the box. It
That's
was
fantastic.
hilarious. I'd definitely love to do my hacking from behind that toaster.
Now that I have enough like free time from not having to travel anywhere, I'm gonna start doing projects like that. I'm gonna see exactly what I can fit inside a toaster.
That instead of us carrying our little pineapple or our little what is it the we have a is it an Intel the NUC, instead of having our little portable NUC in a Pelican case, we'll be carrying our toasters to all our hacking demos.
Plus, then you can make some pretty sweet bagels along the way too.
Fantastic. By the time I've hacked this database, my bagel will be done.
Yes. Just don't burn it like I did this morning to my
SQL
breakfast
injection
bagel.
in 1.5 minutes.
It's
Timed by our bagels. By the way, for the people curious out there, the other organization that might be similar to this one we're talking, Bellingcat, the other one that I know of that's very popular is the Citizen Lab. So check them out at
Yes,
citizenlab.ca.
check them out. Check out the story about this one too, because it's just honestly kind of interesting seeing how people piece together all this information from all these leaked breaches and stuff.
And whether you're a good guy or a bad guy, it also is very eye-opening realizing how much data you're leaking every second that your computer's connected to an
And
ISP.
if you are a bad guy, maybe don't use your last name of date of birth as your password for your email account.
Let alone something that's only 9 characters. I could brute force that on a 5-year-old computer.
Challenge accepted.
So what's our outro, little bunny foo foo? Are we gonna hop into the credits?
Hey everyone, thanks again for listening. As always, if you enjoyed today's episode, don't forget to rate, review, and subscribe.
And
If you
even
have
if
any
you didn't
questions on.
enjoy it, 5 stars are much appreciated. 5 stars for all the
Exactly.
podcasts.
Hooray! If you have any questions on today's topics or suggestions for future episode topics, reach out to us on Twitter. I'm at XORRO underscore, Corey is at SecAdept, and the both of us are at hashtag the443podcast. Thanks again for listening, and we will see you next week with our special 100th episode. Hooray!
I'm just imagining little blue birds reaching out through the inner tubes of the webs. How do they do that?
I don't know, Pop Pop Gory.
Gotta reach out through the Twitters.